Okay, here we go. Homework, details, retracing, metanoia. So this is a conversation with Marshall McLuhan in 1966. Some intellectual guy is interviewing him. So he says, a guy named Mottram, M-O-T-T-R-A-M. Don't have his first name right here. He says, thinking of the progress in your work from The Mechanical Bride, which was 1951, to Understanding Media, 1964, that's where he seemed to drop his moral outrage in Understanding Media. One of the things that struck me was the increased stress on the function of the, and I got to get to the next page, on the function of the artist in society, and on art as anti-environment, as you call it. So he's saying that McLuhan, 15 years later, well, 13 years later, was stressing more of the art, of the role of the artist. So McLuhan says, after the guy says, you're interested in art as anti-environment, as you call it, McLuhan says, or counter-environment, the artist is providing a means of vision. Now, remember, as he's saying this, he's talking about himself. He's really talking about himself as the only viable artist of his day. The artist is providing a means of vision, a means of knowing the world we're in. This awareness came rather slowly. So much attention is given to art as a storehouse of values, as a kind of custodian of achieved experiences, that its function as an immediate creator of perception and a perception of an environment that is otherwise invisible dawned rather slowly. Not talking about himself, he's talking about in the history of art, say, last 500 years. If one thinks of the basic function of art as the providing of the means of knowing the sort of world one lives in, otherwise inapprehensible, like the emperor's new clothes, then the antisocial character of the artist is obviously an essential part of his perceptual apparatus. If he merged with his environment, he would lose all power to perceive it. And the artist, therefore, in his antisocial activity, creates a counter-environment, which creates the means of perceiving the environment. However, it has not been sufficiently stressed that environments are processes. They are not things that remain fixed or static. In our time, it has become very evident that environments are processes because one succeeds another. The mechanical environment is succeeded by electric environments, and the processes involved in an electric environment are altogether different from those involved in any mechanical or typographic or printed one. We still have that Newtonian heritage of assuming that the environment is a relatively stable, fixed thing and that we merely insert ourselves into it somehow. So Mottram responds by saying, one of the problems for me reading Understanding Media came at this point. So he quotes the section. You say, quote, the electric changes associated with automation have nothing to do with the ideologies or social programs. If they had, they could be delayed or controlled. Instead, the technological extension of our central nervous system that we call the electric media began more than a century ago subliminally. Subliminal have been the effects. Subliminal they remain, unquote. Now, does this mean that there will be increasing difficulty in controlling and delaying the effects of media? And McLuhan says, it is very difficult to control something that is not even perceived as occurring. Now, take the case of automation, for example. In jobs, automation requires a great deal of knowing and relatively little doing. But as the level of information rises, the form of work takes on inevitably the character of simple knowing. Jobs, on the other hand, what we call jobs, yes, jobs in quotes, have come from the mechanical age and consist in a highly fragmented form of work. When you introduce highly integrated electric circuits, then highly fragmented specialist forms of work are quite inconsistent with the continuance of such forms of work. And so the job as a kind of human work is disappearing very rapidly. But work as a form of knowing, of just sheer knowledge, is increasing at a tremendous clip. That is what I mean. If people imagine that automation is going to have to be controlled in order to preserve jobs, this belief is based on a complete misunderstanding of the nature of automation and also of the nature of the job. There's never been any analysis of where jobs came from and of what they're made of. And therefore, we are in a very poor position to do anything about defending our jobs or of making any transition to new forms of work. But I'll read that again. Therefore, we are in a very poor position to do anything about defending our jobs or of making any transition to new forms of work. But the integral character of work under electric circuitry means that increasingly not only the individual, but the entire public is folded into the process of knowing and working. And all the old relationships between public and worker and artist and audience, all those relationships are undergoing drastic change in our time, which all the artists have been explaining to us for a century. Mottram says, isn't this arguing the diminution of social and political choice and an extreme narrowing of the field of action by which we can choose in and plan the future? McLuhan says, but at the same time, while the old patterns of choice are diminishing, the new patterns are increasing at a huge clip. But if we refuse simply to notice the new patterns, we can scarcely take advantage of them. The kinds of knowledge necessary for participation and decision-making under these new electric information circuits, the kinds of knowledge are quite different from the old yes-no choices of preferring this or that program, this or that entertainment, this or that candidate. And then we go to the next page. A second. This or that candidate. The type of choice in decision making is, I should think, almost meaningless under conditions of instantaneous information movement. Mottram says, one of the things I know you want to do is to find out more about the environment, and I know you're working on a sensory profile at Toronto. Towards what end is this sensory profile being organized? McLuhan says, one of the immediate processes exerted by environments on populations is arrangement, a hierarchic arrangement of their sensory life in an order of preference. So that given a certain type of environmental order, people will arrange their visual life in relation to their auditory, kinetic, and other sensory life in a special pattern. Now, since television, for example, the visual life of literate societies has taken a considerable tumble. The other values have gone up. You are familiar with these strange restaurants in which you need a flashlight to read the menu. The object is to lower the visual quality so that the visceral and gustatory and other senses will rise up to fill the gap, and you will be overwhelmed by the need for ordering everything on the menu. This kind of shift in the total level of the sensory life is what we're studying. We're studying the effects of technologies, not on people's thoughts or ideas, but on their whole sensory preferential life. And we are studying the changes in the sensory levels of the past 30 years. Now, if a sensory level changes or the outlook of the whole population changes quite subtly and without any verbal warning, without any cortical index, it is like changing the temperature in a room. It's like altering the thermostatic or thermal controls. If you change the temperature 5 or 10 degrees, people's whole physical posture, outlook, everything changes without benefit of any consciousness whatever. And this happens to us every time a motor car comes into the environment, or every time radio or automation or anything like this occurs. It changes the entire sensory order. And this is an area where we can obviously exert controls. We can interfere consciously in our environment to the degree that we can do with thermostats. I read that again. And this is an area where we can obviously exert controls. We can interfere consciously in our environment to the degree that we can do with thermostats. Mottram says, one of the main aims in your work, right through it, as I see it, is a new concept or a redefinition of the concept of the whole man. It's like a rejuvenation of the Renaissance idea, but it's very different from the Renaissance idea. McLuhan says, Renaissance encyclopedism was almost pointed in the direction of the 18th century alphabetic encyclopedias. It was not a very integral one. It was very much additive and accumulative, and it happened to occur in a time when there was still an enormous amount of integral and habitual culture. That's meaning the Middle Ages. But gradually, the fragmenting character of this alphabetic and classificatory culture asserted itself until by the 19th century, people felt completely alienated from themselves, from their work, from learning, simply by the process of fragmentation specialism. Now, under electric conditions, when information moves at instant speeds, you can't really have fragmentation, even if you wanted to. You can't have it in learning or in work or in politics or in anything else. The moment of action and the moment of the consequences and responses to that action are the same moment. And so we are becoming an enormously integral culture. We go on singing the old song of fragmentation and alienation because every society always looks at the preceding age while living in a new current one. The only person who can actually see and sample and savor the time he is actually living in is the artist. And this is why he is such a disagreeable character. The other people are nostalgically oriented towards the past, exactly like Bonanza and the Western movie. The 20th century lives fixedly and somewhat unhappily in the 19th century. Mottram says, would you think that this has to do with the reason why people much prefer watching Batman to the Gemini space capsule? The network got all those letters pouring in and phone calls saying, we want our Batman back. We don't want Gemini, unquote. McCoon says, they were getting a dose of instruction and stenciled information from the commentary on the Gemini episode, and it was interfering with their pet program, Batman. Batman is itself a rather amusing example of the revival of an older form. The old comic book, got to bring this up, the old comic book of the 30s. What was that sentence about? They have their pet program, Batman. Batman is itself a rather amusing example of the revival of an older form. The old comic book of the 30s. Okay, next part. Revivals always have causes, and the cause, I'm pretty sure, of this revival is color television. Color television creates a new preference for new contours, new flat and highly iconic forms of entertainment. Batman is the perfect episode for color television. Television itself prefers cartoons to photographs, but color television insists upon apparently quite rigidly contoured and stylized sculptured images, and Batman appeals in that order very much. Of course, the sounds that go with Batman are also ideally suited to a very visceral sort of person. So Mottram says, what about the mythological content of the Batman stories? Is there not something to be said about that, quite apart from the medium through which they're being projected at the audience? McCoon says, the good guys and the bad guys? Mottram says, well, soaring through space. McCoon says, that is not a very dominant part of the program. However, it's there, and certainly it is a nostalgia. Most of the people in their 30s today read Batman in their adolescence, and they're getting a nice nostalgic revival of their childhood out of Batman that is reassuring and comforting. But nostalgia for preceding environments is the only form of reassurance and comfort that most people attain in life. And so we live always by means of revivals as a way of comforting and reassuring ourselves. Mottram says, this is strange, because at the same time that this revival of the comic strips and the nostalgia for the 30s has been going on, there's been this other extreme art form of The Happening, which claims you as some kind of prophet in some cases. The Happening is certainly the extension of the art form. McLuhan says, you can see that the symbolist poetry of Rambo and Baudelaire or even The Wasteland is a happening in the sense that everything in it occurs at the same time. There's no sequence. There's no storyline. In The Happening, there are no connections. Everything is simultaneous. Everything affects everything at the same moment. The Happening is a world where things happen at once and not in sequence, and so The Happening seems to deprive us of all our... And I got to move this up. Okay, the next part. Everything affects everything at the same moment. The Happening is a world where things happen at once and not in sequence, and so The Happening seems to deprive us of all our... Ooh, it's out of order there, just a second. All right. I lost my place here just a second. Still looking. So he's talking about the happening. Everything is simultaneous. Everything affects everything at the same moment. The happening is a world where things happen at once and not in sequence, and so the happening seems to deprive us of all our usual rational ideas of cause and effect. But contemporary art, the art of the past century, has been explaining this to us very carefully. The happening is a world in which causality is simultaneous and total, and therefore it calls for a completely mythic form of understanding of events. So Matram says, a second, but it is strangely demythologized because the content of this form, again, is very difficult to pick up. There doesn't seem to be any reference. In fact, they seem to deliberately get rid of any reference to existing myths at all, as if they were creating their own mythical world. That's what how he interprets the happening. McClune says, yes, but you could say that in this electric time, we live mythically. We think nostalgically back into the old forms, but we live mythically, meaning we live simultaneously. Everybody in the electric age lives in a world in which all the events occur at the same time as they do in a newspaper. People haven't seemed to notice that any newspaper is a happening, that everything in the paper happens at the same time under the same dateline and has no connection with anything else in the newspaper. There need be no connection between any two events in a newspaper except the dateline. The newspaper as a form, beginning with the telegraph, is a happening, and we live that way. All the events of our lives are now structured as happenings, meaning simultaneities, and we are slow to notice this. Matram says, what kind of hidden aspect of the environment, then, is this particular artistic form projecting, going along your line that the artist is the man who's making us aware and showing us? So what kind of hidden aspect of the environment, then, is this particular artistic form projecting, going along your line that the artist is the man who's making us aware and showing us? What sort of aspect of the environment is the happening showing? Well, he's just been explaining all that, so the guy didn't get it. McClune says, quite simply, the fact that we live involved in a circuit that is simultaneous. So he repeats the simultaneity point. All parts of it are instant and simultaneous, and we are not trained to contemplate that form. We therefore try, now note how Finnegan's Wake is everything simultaneous. We therefore try to break it up into bits, and we think of happenings as little bits of things, an anarchy or anarchic, formless things, which are exactly the opposite of them. The happening is really a new mythology of simultaneity. Myth is that form of explanation of events in which everything is and coheres simultaneously. Let me read that again. The happening is really a new mythology of simultaneity. Myth is that form of explanation of events in which everything inheres and coheres simultaneously. The reason that a literate man cannot think mythically is that he's trained to think in bits that follow and are connected one to another. In happenings, there are no connections. There is simply the coexistence and the instantaneous character. Naturally, it completely upsets the educational establishment or the judicial establishment. The hullabaloo about capital punishment means that you cannot any longer regard a punishment as an isolated, pinpointed event indicating the responsibility of one separate part of any society. This is very confusing. For people who have long been accustomed to assigning guilt, the idea that everybody in the society by mere coexistence in that society is equally guilty is no less confusing for the judiciary than it is for the educator. How does an educator proceed in a world in which all things occur simultaneously? Now think of the Android meme replaying this in the internet. But it was already happening in the analog media. How does an educator proceed in a world in which all things occur simultaneously, in which there's enormously more information and order outside the classroom than there ever could be inside? That's a question McLuhan asks Mottram. Mottram says, one of the problems of assigning guilt at the moment, as you know, concerns the current forms of drug addiction. I've talked particularly to young people in schools and colleges who take LSD on sugar cubes and so on. They have two responses. One is that they want to get an expansion of their consciousness. Another one is that they want to come out of their consciousness completely and vanish and take off. McLuhan says, it's an easy way of dislocating oneself from old habits of perception and of encountering a new environment, a new world directly, immediately. So LSD is an easy way of dislocating oneself from old habits of perception and of encountering a new environment, a new world directly, immediately. I was reading a passage of Finnegan's Wake one time to an LSD fan, and he said, quote, you know, that's exactly like taking LSD. Those shifting levels and experiences all going on like that, he said, are exactly like LSD. So McLuhan says, I think the artist is a more reliable guide to LSD experience than the drug, but it's a very good indicator of the function of art in preparing us for altogether new patterns of perception. So Finnegan's Wake prepared people for LSD. Mottram says, don't you think they're trying to get themselves into a state of their own space, their own little bit of capitulated space into which they want to project themselves like a warm car or a space capsule? They want to cut themselves. Wait just a second. They want to cut themselves. They want to cut themselves off from their environment and live in their own little environment. McLuhan says, we're all rather expert at doing that at all times. In other words, cut yourself off from your environment and live in your own little environment. We're all rather expert at doing that at all times, so that presumably there's a novelty in this experience which has the effect of travel or exotic encounters or surprise. Mottram says, they call it taking a trip. McLuhan says, travel, you see, in our kind of world today, in jet speeds and so on, has lost all its exotic character. In the age of photography, you can be anywhere at any time. Going there physically is always a disappointment compared to having been there first photographically. So the drug may decide this tourist matter. However, the trip idea is related to it may be a very useful pointer. Mottram says, now what about the future of the book itself as a medium? McLuhan says, under electric conditions, not a question mark, but he sounds like it a bit, under electric conditions, well, it has already been indicated that with Xerox, or xerography, the book is about to undergo a major revolutionary form of development. With xerography, the book recovers many of its most primal characteristics that existed with the scribe in the ancient world. With xerography, any reader can become publisher. Any teacher can take any bit out of any book and add it to any other book and publish his or her own book for immediate class use. This is one of the interesting characteristics of the electric age in general, that is an age of service and not of packaging. The book was technologically the first consumer commodity, the first mass-produced uniform package deal. Now with xerography, the book ceases to be a package and becomes an immediate service for the individual reader. He can dial, he can phone, he can have any kind of information Xerox for him according to his own personal needs and capacities on any subject. And instead of going and looking on the shelf for a book, he simply can prescribe according to his knowledge, his linguistic abilities, the kind of book he needs. That is another peculiarity of the electric age in general, that it is a move that it is moving away from a mechanical age of the mass-produced product into the age of tailor-made, custom-made servicing. And this is a complete paradox. In the ancient world, the scribe... Where is this? The scribe. In the ancient world, the scribe was author as well as publisher. And with xerography, any school kid can be author and publisher. He can take any kind of printed materials and add his own soundtrack, his own photographs. He can make his own package. That's like Facebook or MySpace.
Yeah.
But he's saying it 40 years before. He can do an Andy Warhol with a book. He can create all sorts of new forms, art forms, and xerography decentralizes. Thus, the power that has been centralized mechanically in large agencies and large enterprises. Well, I'll read that again. He can create all sorts of new forms, art forms, and xerography decentralizes. Thus, the power that has been centralized mechanically in large agencies and large enterprises. People seem to think that the electric age goes on repeating the pattern of centralism of the mechanical age. We were talking about this about 6 hours ago. It's the exact reverse. Dropoutism is merely one aspect of decentralism resulting from electric circuitry and from electric information movement. Dropoutism can be in politics, in education, in fashions. People can drop out of fashion. They can drop out of education or out of politics. They can drop out of many areas. Camp, what is called camp in the arts, is a dropoutism, a sudden dislocation of a form. For example, the planet itself with satellites now around it is a new environment. The planet itself becomes an old form of camp, an old nose cone, a kind of art form. So we begin to turn to this old thing, the planet, this old spaceship of ours. We begin to turn to it and decide that it could be tidied up. It could be rearranged in altogether a more artistic form, much as people turn to an old stamp collection, old Model Ts, old machines, and so on, and polish them up as art forms. I think this habit of going outside old forms with our new electric environments and turning them into art forms is taking place on an enormous scale. I think this habit of going outside around old forms with our new electric environments and turning them, the old forms, into art forms is taking place on an enormous scale. I can't very easily imagine a bigger scale than turning the planet itself into an art form. A quaint old object that had been the human habitat for many centuries and had now suddenly become something like a Model T, an old thing, an old piece of camp like Williamsburg. Continuing, that's the end. So I'll read that last bit again. So it's threatening artists and their own personal creativity. If you've got huge environments happening that can be regarded as art forms. So he ends by saying, I think this habit of going outside old forms with our new electric environments and turning them, the old forms, into art forms is taking place on an enormous scale. Enormous scale. I can't very easily imagine a bigger scale than turning the planet itself into an art form. A quaint old object that had been the human habitat for many centuries and had now suddenly become something like a Model T, an old thing, an old piece of camp like Williamsburg. So that's the interview. Then they, these other guys started discussing McLuhan, but I don't think I have much of their work here. Let's just read a couple of comments on this interview. So these, professors saw the interview, and they're saying, George Steiner is the first guy. He says, we're talking to you. We're in a studio. We're around a table. You don't see us as you might in television. You aren't reading what we're going to say as you might, let's say, in a book or in a record of this broadcast. Now, McLuhan has taught us to feel that this makes an enormous difference. That's what we're saying, the way we're saying it, the way you're hearing it. Its entire meaning is wrapped up in the medium, in the particular medium we're using. Now, if he's right, and I think a lot of us feel that he is, and that he's going many, many new doors, and that he's opening many, many new doors, the way we're going to think about books, about language, about communication, about the different arts is going to be radically affected by the thought of this enormously exciting iconoclast in Toronto. So calling McLuhan an iconoclast. Now, this is when McLuhan was still sort of appreciated. Jonathan Miller comes in, who 5 years later writes a very damning book of McLuhan. He says, though, in 66, I certainly agree that everything that McLuhan... Oh, just a minute. Bert, you're going in a few minutes, right?
Yes.
Let me see if anybody else is here. Yes, Sean and Sarah. I don't know if that's enough weight to carry on. So... Bill, we will end at this hour. I'll say end now, end soon, end this hour. Okay, send. Okay. So Jonathan Miller comes in and says, I certainly agree that everything that McLuhan says opens new doors. He often opens doors to chaos, but enough of the doors that he opens are exciting and productive to make him worth studying. It seems to me that his real interest lies in the fact that he's done something which very few people have done publicly before, and that is to focus attention on the devices through which we obtain knowledge. These aspects have largely been ignored in the past, or at least have been a province of philosophers or else of neurophysiologists. And for the first time, what McLuhan has done is to bring the nervous system right into the center of the discussion of ordinary communications and of human knowledge in general. Then the third guy, Andrew Forg, says, this is looking at it from a very highly technical point of view. You mentioned philosophers and neurophysiologists. My interest in Marshall McLuhan comes from the following point, that my major concern is to do with visual arts. Here is somebody who is arguing a complete view of the world as a whole, taking in all the media of ordinary human communication. He extends this to, and then end of the clip. So, that's where we get with that article. Now, is there anything that's shorter and briefer?
I don't know if it's my familiarity of you covering McLuhan, but that was probably the most comprehensive explanation of how McLuhan covered so many areas of his view of the environment, the artist.
Yeah.
And the planet, it was really, I was like, wow, I've never heard it that way. I've never heard that such a comprehensive explanation.
Yeah, McLuhan's statement you're talking
yes.
about, what I read. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because it's an interview. It's expository. He's explaining himself where he's being difficult in his books on purpose to jolt you a bit to the simultaneity, but... He, in classroom and in this, you know, one-on-one interview, he's explaining himself, and therefore you'll hear parts of his sentences that he wrote that he didn't write. You'll hear them filled in here. So it becomes a lot easier to understand, and that's why I read all his articles and interviews, because it filled in what was missing.
Yes. I mean, he considers himself an artist, but when I was listening to it, I was getting the a scientific perspective when he was going to the sense ratios and everything. It was really quite comprehensive. I mean, it's very scientific, if you want to use that word, scientific. I mean, he's using it. He considers himself as an artist, but to be able to outline sense ratios and how, you know, going into a restaurant, they dim the light so that the other sense ratios would be enhanced.
Encourage the other senses and make you eat more.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just amazing.
Right. So what he said the integral person worth listening to is someone who knows the implications of new knowledge in his time or her time.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be the artist or scientist. So Marshall oscillates between the two, back and forth, and any other specialism, because he's talking about the environment is itself more than art, science, and history, and everything put together. So like Thomas Wake, which blurs all the categories and the distinctions, he's going to try to present the fact that we are programming the whole world and all the different older media are his content. So it's very encyclopedic. So he is being whatever the environment he's encountering or people he's encountering that he wants to prompt. So good observation there. Yes, it's meant to be that way. That's why I'm reading it. See that? Well, I'll say this after the music.
There be nothing to fix, hold, or fold. Nothing to lift, or find, or transfer. Nothing to sleep on, or remember. Nothing to hide, forget, or figure out. Nothing to conceal, or carry, or break, wear down, wear out, or bury. Sweetheart,